This talk has been brought to you by the Center for Philosophical Research, Warsaw, Poland. Check our webpage at www.obf.edu.pl.
Kazimierz Naturalist Workshop, 2008. David Papineau, The Poverty of Analysis.
So I'm going to talk about naturalism, this being a topic on naturalism. I'm going to talk specifically about methodological naturalism. So I'm going to be talking about the nature of philosophy, philosophical methodology, what we're doing when we do philosophy. And methodological naturalism is very vaguely the view that philosophy and science are the same thing. It'll get more precise than that in a second. I feel a bit embarrassed talking about this subject. I was brought up largely by Hugh Miller, not to worry about the nature of philosophy. He thought it was somehow decadent. You should do philosophy. You shouldn't talk about philosophy. You should do it. But I somehow got interested in this navel-gazing subject, and I hope you'll think it's interesting and not just decadent. So here's a little plan of what's going to come. I'm first of all going to be a bit more specific about what I mean by philosophy and science are the same thing. I'm going to explain, I don't intend this as a particularly revisionary thesis. I'm going to say a couple of things, empirical data, philosophers who must describe their practice, defending my account of philosophy, and I'm going to talk quite a lot about what's going on when we have used thought experiments about possible cases to address philosophical issues. I'll say a bit about a priori and a posteriori knowledge. And at the end, I'll say a bit about modal knowledge and we'll relate some things to Karen's knowledge. So, here's a way of making the idea precise. I say that philosophy, just like science, aims to formulate true synthetic claims about the actual world. And these claims are to be evaluated in just the same way as scientific claims are evaluated. Now, there's various ways of defending this thesis. In a sense, this is a kind of contrast thesis. I mean, if one's putting forward this, it's normally in opposition to some other account of what philosophy is. And in today's talk, the alternative view that I will try and discredit is the view that philosophy is involved with conceptual analysis. It analyzes concepts and always arrive at distinct analytic truths. Now, there's some audiences where this would be kind of an outrageous claim. Of course, philosophy is conceptual analysis, but I suspect that here nobody feels terribly keen to defend that, and nobody in what we've done so far has shown the slightest inclination to defend that account of philosophy. So perhaps what I'm saying today can be made more controversial for this audience by going back the other way. When I say philosophy is a synthetic discipline, I wanted to say something much more much less surprising, much less radical than many other people who take this view of philosophy. I don't think that this implies that we ought to be doing something different in philosophy. My view is that, by and large, this is a sociological case, so it's not anything particularly strictly, but by and large, my view is that what philosophers already do is synthetic theorizing. And my view that philosophy is a synthetic theorizer, therefore, doesn't suggest that philosophers ought to be doing something different from what they're already doing. In particular, I don't think the philosophers need to suddenly start going out and gathering empirical data. I think philosophy is just fine continuing to address the issues they address from the armchair, to think about possible cases, to use thought experiments, All that's perfectly fine.
So in this respect, I'm rather different from various other people who think of philosophy as continuous with science. In particular, recently there's been Hilary Hornblith and Stephen Stitcher in different ways have advocated the view that philosophers ought to go out and get their hands dirty with actual empirical data. Hornblith and Stitcher have rather different views. I mean, Hornblith's views, and will turn out not to be that different from mine. In the end, it's just that I take the methodology of thought experiments to be worthwhile than he does. Stitcher's got funny views at the moment. I think he's experimental philosophy. His view is philosophers ought to go out and gather data. But rather oddly, what he thinks they ought to gather data about is what people think about things. And it's kind of interesting subject. He finds out that's quite a bit of exciting things. But why he thinks that that's somehow a natural part of philosophy is not at all clear. It looks like a bit of kind of social psychology. How it relates to the problem of investigation is rather obscure. Okay, so my view is that philosophy is synthetic, but that doesn't mean we should be doing anything different from what we're already doing. Okay, it might seem that there's two immediate reasons why you should think that if philosophy is synthetic, surely it means that we ought to be doing something different. So here's one point. If philosophy is synthetic, then doesn't its claims have to be assessed against empirical data? And by and large, philosophers don't. Gathering empirical data, so don't immediately follow from what I said, philosophy is synthetic, that we should be looking at empirical data much more than we do. So it's one immediate reaction that I want to address. Another immediate reaction is, look, surely I'm saying that philosophy should be doing something different, because a lot of philosophers go around doing conceptual analysis. And if I said philosophy's aim is synthetic truths, surely I'm saying we should be doing something different. In response to that, I say, no, the people who say they're doing conceptual analysis, that's fine, they can carry on doing what they're doing. What they need to realize is what they're doing isn't conceptual analysis. They think they're doing conceptual analysis, but they're mistaken. Let me take those two points. So, first issue is, well, doesn't it follow from what I've said that philosophical theories need to be evaluated against hard empirical data? Doesn't that seem to be wrong, or at least something that hard philosophy can be done very differently? Well, I think, there's cases and cases. I mean, the first one to make is that quite a lot of philosophical theories do answer to empirical data in a pretty direct way. I mean, there's lots of stuff in philosophy of mind, philosophy of biology, which, I mean, it's not contentious, I won't go into that, but that these are pretty much just continuous with the kinds of empirically accessible theories that But even in more central areas of philosophy, I think there are theories that have pretty direct empirical implications. I mean, think of interactive dualism, the theory that the mind is separate and the mind affects the physical world. I mean, that has a pretty direct empirical implication, that somewhere you can find in the physical world bits of matter moving about in a way that's not accounted for by physical causes. And if anything's a philosophical view of interactive dualism, this is very direct. And if you ask me the reason that interactive dualism is not taken seriously anymore, it's precisely because there's lots of evidence that empirical implication is not borne out. People have looked a lot in just the kind of places you might expect to find this in the brain, and they don't find any of it in ways that can't be accounted for. I mean, that kind of claim, there are no cases where this is a kind of negative existential claim which can't even
just to be established. But I think there's lots of empirical investigation that's made without discussing that implication of this thesis. Libertarian free will. Some people say there is free will. Free will requires absence of determinism. Those two things together are a very direct empirical implication. Determinism is not. In that case, that implication is true. But again, there are philosophical theories that are substantial and pretty obvious empirical implications. But perhaps these are special cases. I mean, there's lots of other philosophical disputes about the existence of universals or the nature of persisting objects, where the different views don't seem to have any different empirical convictions. But I don't think it follows from that what's going on here isn't the formulation of alternative synthetic theories of the same kind that we get in science. Part of the issue here is, I think, I mean, something I haven't said, I mean, I do think there are differences between philosophy and science. I mean, sometimes when I give talks in philosophy to just science, people say, no, look, it's quite different, I mean, philosophical debates go on much longer, I mean, of course there are differences. And the kinds of problems that generate philosophical discussion are different from the ones that generate discussion in science departments. And I've got a couple of things to say about what makes philosophical problems different from scientific ones. And they're both still aiming to develop synthetic theories, but philosophical problems are different from scientific ones. And these differences can explain why, characteristically, philosophical problems don't get resolved So, one obvious point is that many philosophical problems are very abstract and general. And we worry about, are there universals, what's the nature of causation? Is there an observable world, and so on. I mean, these are questions that cover all aspects of reality. They aren't like, these are inherent sort of like characteristics and kind of local issues like that. And to that extent, you wouldn't expect differing theories on these very general matters to be decidable by a few bits of empirical data. They're too general they're too central in our theoretical work for any bits of empirical investigation to bear on. So that's one reason why philosophical theories are special, and with that we get an explanation of why we shouldn't expect to resolve them by looking at empirical data. And how are we going to resolve them? Well, which theory is the best, simplest, keenest overall account of reality? Which, if you think about it, is the kind of consideration that at some point has to be brought into science as well. Science, you get a determination theory by data, and in cases like that, you have to decide between theories on grounds other than looking at different predictions, because the different theories that have in those cases are different predictions. In fact, not all philosophical issues are of this very central general kind. I mean, there are also philosophical problems that are very peculiar and local. I mean, is there weakness of the will? Does originality matter in art? You've got two molecule for molecule identical paintings, and one's made about Picasso and one is a copy. Does it matter? And I think what's going on, I mean, those are characteristic philosophical problems. They are generally very, very specific. Why are they philosophical if, as I say, they're just different synthetic theories? Well,
What's going on in those cases, and I think that also applies to some extent to the is that we've got ourselves in a theoretical tangle. This is a characteristic situation of philosophy. You can argue from plausible premises for one conclusion, and you can argue equally from plausible premises for the opposite conclusion, and something is wrong somewhere. There's something that you're assuming which is intent to other things you're assuming, and the trick is to figure out what's going on. Often, what's making us end up with these conclusions is that we're being influenced by assumptions that we don't even realize we've got. And part of philosophy is to try and figure out what are the assumptions that are driving us to these various conclusions, and then when we've got one on the table, we can figure out which ones we might want to jettison. So, that's another characteristic of philosophy, that it tries to unravel things when we're in some kind of theoretical tangle. And if you think about the nature of that kind of difficulty, you can see why it's not going to be resolved by getting more empirical data. The problem isn't characteristically that we have too little empirical data. The problem is that we don't know what's the best theory to explain it. So, that's a picture of what makes philosophy special, that answers the question, well, if it's synthetic, shouldn't it always be resolved by data? No, philosophy differs from science, not in that its theories aren't synthetic, but that the kinds of cases where philosophers get called in are the cases where getting at the right theory isn't something that needs to be resolved by getting into the data. Now, I've just got to this point. There's something I wanted to say earlier. I'm going to be talking mostly about metaphysics, metaphysical issues. I don't know, philosophy of mind, philosophy of language. And kind of in a way, they're the best cases for me, because it's going to be easier to argue in those cases than what we're doing is synthetic theorizing. There are other bits of philosophy, in particular, ethics, political theory, value theory, and perhaps also mathematics and logic, where it's a bit weird to say what's going on is synthetic theorizing. And I mean, I'm inclined to defend my claim for those areas too. But in those areas, the plausibility of my claim will hinge to a large extent on taking sides in philosophical debates about the nature of ethics, about the nature of mathematics. And I don't want to get bogged down in that. So let me stick to the kind of metaphysics philosophy of mine where there aren't alternative views about the nature of those subject matters that I have to deal with. So we can talk about ethics and mathematics and later. Okay, now I want to spend a bit of time dealing with the other immediate thoughts. The thought that surely, if I'm right, philosophy should go differently, because think of all the philosophers who say they do conceptual analysis. And what I wanted to talk about is different ways in which different philosophers have kind of confused themselves in thinking they're doing conceptual analysis when they in fact aren't. And I mean, I'm going to distinguish different routes to this kind of confusion, but they all kind of stem from the tendency to muddle up theories with concepts. Now, one way in which you can do this is if you're inclined to verificationist thinking about concepts. If you want a kind of picture of who I'm talking about here, think of Quine as the paradigm of somebody who's the verifications of our concepts. And I'm going to be suggesting that that's all bad. Let me say something else, just a little clarification point here. You're immediately going to start thinking about analytic synthetic distinction. Because there's an analytic synthetic distinction, it's not really possible to separate concepts from theories. I think that's a red herring. I have no strong views about those antecedents, but the points I'm going to be making apply equally if there's a strong antecedent or if there isn't. The points I'm going to be making now are to do with verificationism and not to do with antecedents.
devastation. So we just put that, forget about that as a devastation, that's a red herring. This is what I was saying, if you're so not convinced it's a red herring, ask me about it afterwards. The kind of verificationism that I want to draw attention to now is the one that says, well, the nature of your concepts are constituted by your dispositions to apply them in response to sensory evidence. So, here's a bit of concept. That's to do with the fact that he's going to apply his concepts, his sort of concepts, to various general situations, somebody who differently attaches a different meaning to the word, expresses a different concept by the word. It's a kind of thought. And if you think of concepts in that way, well, then you might well think that if you're in the business of thinking about the assumptions people make that lead them to certain concepts like free will or conscious or metaphysical concepts in response to certain bits of evidence, then you'll be analysing their concepts. And I mean, this is a very, Robert Brandon is the most clear example of something like this. He talks explicitly about how what he's doing, he calls it conceptual analysis, is looking at the way people infer to various theoretical judgments from observations. Sellers like infer from the theoretical judgments various implications of a practical and other kind. And he's interested in assessing whether that's a good way to do things and criticizing it on the grounds of abuse of people into the states. And he says that's analyzing concepts. Well, I've nothing against what he's doing there. I think that's exactly what philosophers should do. They should think about the way that people respond to evidence, make judgments. And analyze and assess whether they're doing it in a good way. But I would call it analyzing the theories that people, I wouldn't even call it analyzing because it's implied when I say that, you know, identifying and assessing the theories that people. So, if somebody thinks that they're doing the same analysis because they're doing the kind of thing Brandon has in mind, I say, well, that's all absolutely fine. It's just the kind of thing I say possible to be doing. And all I disagree about is your thought that's named into your concepts. Why is it a bad thing to think of concepts in this way? Well, I won't go into that. I mean, the difficulties are familiar. If you think of concepts in this way, every time you change your theory, you change your concepts, people with different theories can't communicate with each other. If you cease to believe a theory, you can't use terms of that theory with the same meaning as the people who believe the theory, and so you can't say, for instance, there are no witches, thereby denying what the people who believe in witches were saying. And it's a lot. So one doesn't want to think of the relation between theories and concepts. Right. Forget about verifications. I'm going to look at a better way of thinking about the relation between theories and concepts. Now, this is kind of what everybody ought to think about the relation between theories and concepts. Your formatting is going to be funny here. This shouldn't be italics down there. The F's in italics. This ought to be what everybody thinks about relation between theories and concepts. It kind of isn't as well appreciated as it should be. And I think that's partly because of a different consideration. What happened with all that pioneer mess I was talking about? I mean, conventionality theories about the concepts. So we all stopped worrying about it because we became externalists about meaning. Following Kripke patterns. Remember the problem of theory changing conventionality, all that stuff? It kind of died as a subject because Putnam came along and said references fix externally, and so concepts don't change in their context. change, and the author happens to like leave it like that. But externalism about concepts isn't controversial, and it's quite arguable that quite a lot of concepts in science and in philosophy get their content determined, their reference fixed by their associations with scriptures. And what I want to think about it is how things will work if that's so. So, for the moment, I'm going to go along with the idea that concepts are, as I put it, constituted by theories, their reference is fixed by the role they play in theory, and show you how, even so, there's a way of thinking about those between concepts and theories, which is quite different from the primary verifications way of doing it. And this is the way of thinking about it, developed by Ramsey and Carnap, and rediscovered and defined by David Lewis. So suppose that G of F is our theory involving concepts. Don't stick. Now again, how much do you stick into T? The whole theory, some part of it, I don't want to worry about that too much. Just as much of the theory as you want to have determining the content of F. So here's a little baby example, our concept of belief, but it's not a given concept. Let's suppose the theory is beliefs are caused by perception, and they interact with other beliefs that arise to generate actions, and they have some internal constituent causal structure. That's our theory of belief. Okay, here's the Ramsey sentence. Ramsey sentence is familiar. You quantify into the position of the theoretical terms. So you don't say beliefs respond to perceptual evidence and interact with beliefs and desires and generate actions and have internal causal structure. You say there are things which. And so, you get rid of the term F, you just quantify to say, what you believe. Look at Ramsey. The Ramsey sentence is clearly disengaged. It says, there are states that are caused by perceptions, that interact with other states, that generate behavior, that have an enormous. That's what perception is. That there are such things in the world is a substantial thing. It's quite independent of the meaning of the term F. Pretty obvious, because I don't even use the term F. I can't have anything to do with the meaning of the term. Okay. What's the connection between the theory T and the content of the concept F? Well, to get at that, what we want to look at is not the Ramsey sentence, but the Carnap sentence. The Carnap sentence says, is there anything that responsive evidence and dragon and all that stuff, then their beliefs. Now, this sentence can plausibly be viewed as analytic. It doesn't tell you anything about what's actually in the world, it just tells you about how we're going to use the term F. There's various ways of doing this. You can imagine, you can think of this as a. Think of the term. F's content being fixed by a stipulation. Goes like this. Let's use the term F in such a way as to make this claim come out true. That's one way in which you can use that claim to fix the content of F. An alternative way, if you would have a description operator in your language, you could just say F's belief equals by definition the state which T. And that's either of those will make this claim come out analytic. Okay, so here we have our original theories decomposed into synthetic Ramsey sentence and an analytic Carnap sentence, and it can also be used as the one defining the content of F. Okay. So I hope that on the last that was all supposed to be kind of uncontroversial. I think that many people who are supposed to, in fact, profess to be experts on, familiar with Ramsey and Carnap,
still muddle up synthetic theorizing with conceptual analysis. I'm thinking primarily of Frank Jackson and the Canberra planners, but there's quite a lot of people who, if you look at what they write, make the same kind of mistake. So the Canberra planner, I hope, is familiar. This is somebody who says, well, here's how we do philosophy. We start off with everyday thinking. We look at the platitudes of the everyday folk, and we see what the everyday think. People think that beliefs are, and feudal is, and moral right and wrong is, and anything else that we find philosophically interesting. And so the first job is to figure out what the everyday idea of belief, feudal, whatever it is. And then you can do serious metaphysics once you've identified the subject matter. You go a little bit more serious view of the world. Physics, but that's not essential. The best theories tell you, and then you see whether in the stuff your best theories tell you, there are things corresponding to the everyday ideas that we mean. So, first of all, you figure out what the folks think about belief, which is the kind of thing I just said, and then you go to serious psychology and you see whether there really are any things like that. And if connections is right, maybe there aren't. And if computations and that's kind of serious philosophy of psychology. You see whether you can locate in your best theories of the world reference to the everyday ideas. But Jackson says what we start with is analysing the folk concepts, and that's conceptual analysis. And that's why his book is from Metaphysics to Ethics. Conceptual analysis. I just don't see why he views what he's doing in that way. Why does he think this is conceptual analysis? Here's an alternative to what he's doing. And in fact, sometimes he says this is what he's doing. He's identifying the Ramsey sentence of everyday thinking. He's noting that everyday people think there are things with responsive evidence, etc., etc. And once you've figured out that's what they think, well, then you might well be interested in whether your best theory in the world vindicates what they think. But if you ask me, and I've been using think and idea to be kind of fudgy here, if you ask me, the only way to make sense of what Jackson says he's doing is that you're starting off by identifying the folk theory, the substantial Ramsey theory, synthetic theory of what's in the world, and not with the folk product sense. What makes you worry about serious metaphysics and try and solve the location problem is the proposition that there are things of certain kinds according to the folk. I'm going to check out whether that's true. What sets the philosophical agenda is the folk's synthetic Ramsey thoughts. What doesn't set the agenda is the fact that the folk are inclined to suppose that if there's certain things of a certain kind, they'll call them such and such. That's not going to get anybody trying to solve the location. Let me give you an example to drive this home. Take the folk concept of a soul. Right? Okay, souls are entities that conscious, that are associated with bodies and surviving, let's suppose. Okay? Well, as being fudgy there, the Ramsey sentence is that there are entities that are conscious, associated with bodies, surviving, etc. The Carnap sentence is there anything like that, then they're souls. Now think about it. We all believe the Carnap sentence. The Carnap sentence defines the concept of the soul, it's part of the definition, we all have the concept of the soul, that's what soul means. I take it that not everybody here believes in Ramsey sentence. Does the fact we all have this concept of the soul mean that we ought to start worrying about the location problem with respect to soul? Should we now rush off and look in? Obviously not. The fact that we've got a concept of a soul that can be analysed in that way It's neither here nor there, because none of us know. Don't believe there are any souls, and so you can just put this in your kind of dictionary and get on to stop worrying about serious issues that we are interested in. So, what Jackson is actually doing is surely looking at everyday theories and then looking to see if just to see whether they're born out. And what he isn't doing is looking at everyday concepts, because everyday concepts per se carry no commitment to the existence of the things that concepts would refer to if they did refer. And this confusion of starting with everyday theorizing and analyzing everyday concepts is pretty rife in literature. I mean, if you look through the literature on intuitions in epistemology, in big debates over the last 10 years, you'll find people defending intuitions, saying, right, we have to start with conceptual analysis. Alvin Goldman is a very clear case of this. But when you look at what he actually says, it's pretty clear that what he's actually talking about is starting with everyday things, and not with everyday concepts at all. So, second case of people who say they're doing conceptual analysis, but they're not. In fact, what they're doing seems to me a very good thing to do, and entirely in line with my view of possible. We have all kinds of theories. We have kind of commonsensical everyday theories. We all work with them and grow up with them. And then we have our serious scientific theories, our best theories. And a very important part of philosophy is to see how far our commonsensical theories that we work with and grow up with are actually borne out by the things we really have assessed and believe in. And that's entirely in line with my vision of philosophy. But it's not conceptual analysis. Okay, let me now turn to thought experiments and the methodology of possible cases. In a few places, Jackson and others say, in defense of what I've just been scorning, the idea that philosophy involves conceptual analysis, they say, look, it must involve conceptual analysis because our characteristic way of assessing philosophical theories is by seeing if we can find imaginary possible counterexamples. And the fact that we can discredit these theories just by imagining a possible counterexample, they say, shows that these theories can only be making claims of conceptual necessity and not making claims about the actual world, because claims about the actual world couldn't possibly be discredited just by imagining a possible counterexample. That's kind of plausible enough line of mind to do. And, I mean, there are a few classic thought experiments of this kind, which are produced in this context, and I guess I'll be talking about Sergetia. I mean, the theory is K different only of 2 + 5 leaves, and the truth of knowledge. And then you think about the Smith and the Ford and so on, and you think, okay, here's a case belief, and it's not knowledge because for the point, this is a case where the truth of the belief is accidental relative to the method of justification, and just by imagining a case and thinking what we say about it, we know that a case like that is knowledge. Critically gives us the case of, right, he's arguing it's a descriptive theory of names, so necessarily the thesis, the name refers to the entity that satisfies descriptions, most of the descriptions associated with it. And he says, oh, no, in this case, the Gödel associated with the theorem, supposed to be the theorem, Gödel ripped it off, so think about that case. What does the word Gödel refer to there? It refers to Gödel and Schmidt, even though Schmidt satisfies the description. So therefore, by thinking about this possible case, we have to prove the starting. And so doesn't the fact that we can just disprove philosophical theses by imagining possible cases discredit the philosophical thesis of substantial scientific theories about the natural world? Well, I say no, not necessarily. This thing is scientific. There are plenty of cases in science where we discredit theories about the actual world, manifesting synthetic theories by imagining possible cases
microcosmos. The classic example in this world, quite a few is Galileo. Bodies have seen the same thing. Possibly. Lighter ones and Galileo's as well. Think about the case we have a heavy cannonball, little cannonball, you tie together with a piece of string, show you that will fall at the same speed as either of them, and therefore that this compound body, the heavy one, doesn't go faster, so much aerosol. Very good thought experiment. Effectively displayed as aerosol. But the Ashing theory is clearly a synthetic. It's not a matter of perception analysis that everybody's might fall on faster. The right ones are, it's a claim about how things are in the natural world. So here we do exactly the same. We imagine possible counter examples and we display synthetic things. So I want to say the same thing is going on in philosophy. Descriptive theory, descriptive theory of names, standardized knowledge is an attempt at a true synthetic theory about what's going on in the natural world, and we just made it just as Galileo does by thinking about possible cases. Okay, you might say this is not a good analogy. And there is a rather striking asymmetry. Galileo is supposing that if you have two bodies tied together by a piece of string, they fall at the same speed. And perfectly reasonable thoughts, and something that strikes you as intuitively true. But in that case, it's pretty clear it's a guess as to what would happen in a natural case. And that it's perfectly possible that if you actually went and did the thing, you might find out, rather surprisingly, that it didn't work like that. That the little body did slow the big one down, or something. Still, it wouldn't be what Galileo was expecting. So, in that case, the intuition is just a guess as to the empirical facts, and it's potentially falsifiable by going to the natural case. And that goes hand in hand with the fact that you've got an empirical claim here. You could have a body like this before my map, which is appropriate to testing an empirical theory. But in the philosophical cases, it looks rather different. I mean, is there any room for evidence to disprove the intuition that an accidental true believer isn't a knower, or the intuition that the thing that satisfies description that isn't the origin of the use of the term isn't the bearer? You think about this, so you want to go look at a real case and see, find a real case of somebody who's actually true believer and see whether they're a knower? No, because we already know what we're going to say in that case. Because of our reflection on the case. We know beforehand that if we came across such a case, we would judge the person not as a knower. And that's why, in the philosophical case, there's a sense in which the thought experiment is all you need. You don't, in addition, need to go and look at some real cases to see whether the intuition is born out, because you already know what you're going to say about real cases. And that certainly, at first pass, makes it look like what we're doing is thinking about our concepts and using that to assess putative analyses of concepts. And just put, if, as I claim, these intuitions are synthetic claims about how things will work in the actual world, then they ought to be falsified by similar observations. And if they aren't falsified by your observations, then surely they can't be synthetic claims about how things will work in the actual world. But I say that's too fast. And I say what we have here is like a case of theory-dependent observation. I want to say that the assumption that an accidental true believer isn't a knower is built in. We have a judgmental module for assessing whether somebody's a knower or not. And that logic has built into it the assumption of the maximum believers on notes. Simply we have here a module for judging whether something is very limited. And that has built into it the assumption that there. And if you think of the setup in that way, well, then the relevant assumptions can both be synthetic claims about how things are going to go in the actual world, even though they aren't going to be falsifiable by any simple observations. It's a standard case of the theory of dependence of observation. Perceptual modules, observational modules, are informed by various synthetic claims about the world, and that means you aren't going to have any immediate observations that but for all that, it's synthetic claims.
So,
that's the model I want to offer you of what's going on. There are synthetic claims about how things are going to go in the world, but you aren't going to get any knockdown counterexamples just by making more observations, because these claims are built into your observational procedures. They might be discredited by more elaborate means. You might start thinking more about the nature of knowledge and the importance of knowledge and what makes us interested in thinking about this as well, right? But I think really was thinking about the aim of the concept. And you might, reflecting on that, come to the conclusion that it's a mistake to suppose that accidentality of truth undermines knowledge. I actually don't think that's true, so it's not a very good kind of, if you think about that outside of, that's not the point I'm making. I'm just pointing to how it might be that that assumption could be empirically disconfirmed, even though it might be direct. Also, okay, you might be worrying about the onus of argument here. What I've just pointed out is that the structure, the phenomena of philosophical thought experiments are consistent with the idea that the theories being assessed as synthetic and they're being evaluated, being tested by synthetic intuitions about how things are going to actually work. And if you suppose that the assumptions are built into actual hypotheses, that makes the philosophical practice consistent with that kind of what's going on. But I haven't really ruled out, I've kind of shown there's nothing wrong with my view, but I haven't discredited the alternative view that this is conceptual analysis. So you might well want to know, do I have any arguments against the idea that philosophical thought experiments are doing conceptual analysis? And, I mean, here's a couple of thoughts. I mean, I won't have time to do them in detail. Those of you who've read Tim Williamson's book, The Philosophy of Philosophy, came out a couple of years ago, will know that he argues very forcefully against the idea that philosophical knowledge is analytic. But he does it by appealing to very strong externalist assumptions. I mean, basically he thinks that what makes your term refer to something is kind of external causal relations, and this thing out there, and your term kind of locks onto it, and that's quite independent of any assumptions you have involved in the term. And he argues that by making it plausible that somebody could possess a concept, it really refers to something, and this person could believe just about anything at all involved in the concept. Meaning, yes, people with the concept of vision, but they don't do those poems, and this is very and so, no intuitions are required by your possessing the concepts, and no one can be related. So that's how he argues. I think that, and this goes back to the question of do we want to think about concepts as having their context defined, their association with their descriptions. I think that even if we aren't so strong externalists, we do think some of our concepts have their content constituted by descriptions, we still have reason to think that what's going on in philosophical experiments is not just analysing the concepts involved, but trying to assess the substantial theories. And the thought is just this. If what we're doing is conceptual analysis, the philosophical experiments will be much less interesting than they actually are. I mean, I take it that what Kripke has told us about is how names work in the actual world. He's the man in the house. He's told us about names, right? He hasn't told us just about how we think about names, and we wouldn't call something a name if it didn't pick out the origin rather than the varying descriptions. But what's more, he's persuaded us that names in the real names in the actual world work like that. The things we think of as names actually are names in the appropriate sense. And similarly, I think the Gator is telling us about knowledge, not telling us about what we're going to call knowledge if there is any such thing. Okay? Right, this just goes back to the Ramsey-Carnap sentence again. It's not just telling us how we're going to use terms, the philosophical experience is telling us about what's actually there in the world. Okay, I don't want to spend too much on this. Tim Williamson has very similar views. I mean, a lot of what I think about this is informed by reading his book about thought experiments. I mean, he has a lot of stuff about counterfactuals and so on, but I skip past that. He's rather insistent that we shouldn't think of philosophy as a posteriori. And I used to be resistant to that because I wasn't really thinking much about the difference between synthetic and a posteriori. But I'm now not so fussed about that. The synthetic is an important thing, not really a posteriori. What is more interesting, and these alternatives have come from nowhere, is not whether the philosophical assumptions are a priori or a posteriori. His reason for denying the a posteriori is that they kind of aren't based on direct observation. We didn't go and make lots of observations of cases and thereby conclude that all known knowers are accidental true believers, or that we can get some kind of names by making lots of observations and making them back to generalization. So he wants to say, well, they're not a posteriori, right? They're not really a priori either. He says this kind of dichotomy shouldn't be applied here. I'm not fussed about that, but I do think what's more interesting is what is the status of these intuitions, how authoritative are they, what weight will be for them. And Williamson, along with the ninth and a posteriori, kind of suggests that they're kind of authoritative. Philosophers are really good at having intuitions, and their intuitions can tell us the truth. I think that's a rather difficult thing for him to maintain. And one way to argue that is to think about their status as encapsulated. Where did they come from, these assumptions we have? Again, the range of the origin of the useful term. Is it something given to us by evolution? I mean, I don't know if that's very really positive for me. It might be, with knowledge, our assumptions about knowledge. Is it that our cultures have kind of imbued us with this kind of thought when we're very young, and so we kind of build it into our judgment of procedures? Early experience, you might just learn some of the cases. Who knows where it comes from, but none of the plausible accounts of where these assumptions come from give them a very high level of authority. They aren't the kind of pedigree that should make you confident in these assumptions. And of course, this worry about the authority of our physical intuitions is confirmed by all the work in experimental philosophy. The work of the Deleuze, inspired by Stitchin and Associates, which show that different people of different geographical backgrounds, different class backgrounds, differ quite significantly in their intuitions about knowledge and names, just intuitions that are involved in the Kripkean and Gettier thought experiment. And who knows what to make of that stuff, but one thing that at least shows, if different people have different intuitions of the same kind, which are incompatible, they can't all be true. And so we should
be rather suspicious of the authority of intuitions. Okay, there's things I might discuss here about how good or bad this makes intuitions. I mean, there's this kind of spectrum here. From Williamson, who thinks, it seems to be highly plausible, that the intuitions of philosophers, at least, really should always be trusted in these matters, to Cornwith, who thinks these intuitions are completely worthless, and what we must do is go out and actually do the important work to check. I think there's the plausible positions in between, that it is important to philosophy to be able to work with intuitions, but we shouldn't assume that our intuitions about possible cases are always authoritative. And in a way, Williamson and Cornwith look at this as a kind of asymmetrical situation. We have the theory, we have the intuition. Some people say the intuitions win every time, Cornwith says the intuitions are worth it. I don't think of it as a kind of theory versus intuition set up in the first place. I think a better way to look at it is you've got some bits of theory, some assumptions over here, and then you've got other assumptions that are behind the judgment about counterexample, and these assumptions are inconsistent. It's just the kind of thing I was talking about much earlier. We have a whole complicated network of beliefs, and we find sometimes that there's tension in these beliefs, there are different beliefs in inconsistent conclusions, and we've got to do some sorting out. And I think that the real significance of thought experiments in philosophy is they're just a way of articulating that kind of theoretical tension. To that extent, I mean, they're very useful, they help you to see that you've got assumptions that perhaps you didn't realize you had. So think of them like that. They're just a way of identify and figure out the structure of our theoretical canons. Last point, and I want to do this because it relates to the thing that came up with the brain of the rat. Some people worry, given what I've said, that this is kind of misrepresenting the subject matter of philosophy. Isn't philosophy concerned with necessities, unlike science, which is concerned with contingencies? And I think some of them contrasted necessary metaphysics with contingent science. There's certainly many philosophers who think philosophy involves contingencies and think that the importance of that is it gives us a route to the modal subject matter which is essential to philosophy. If you think of Chalmers and Jackson and George Beaver, they want to articulate it in the kind of power starting analysis context. We can get to knowledge of what necessary and possible. And they think that's the essential nature of philosophy. I'm happy to agree that a lot of philosophy is concerned with claims that are necessary. It's not possible. The modern things. But I don't think, I think it's just that, postscriptively, we know that that doesn't mean that it's concerned with analytically rather than synthetic claims. Changes and very things are necessary. So, just as science is often said, what's the nature of water, what's the nature of space, and the things that they find out all the way through is necessary. So is philosophy, what's the nature of causation, what's the nature of existing objects, we're given that necessities, but they're synthetic necessities. I think that the reason these things are necessary is just because certain kinds of claims about natural, synthetic claims about natural, are necessary if true. Claims about one person being identical with another, if it's true, it's necessary. Claims about one substance being identical with another, if it's true, it's necessary. So, given that philosophers are often concerned with facts about identity, and constitution, and origin, facts of the kind which, if true, are necessary, they can't help but be concerned with claims of necessity and possibility. But In the first instance, they're concerned with synthetic claims about the actual world, which, as it happened, have implications as to what is necessary and possible. And they aren't doing some mysterious and hard to analyze, hard to understand kind of reasoning that starts with conceptual analysis, takes you to modal conclusions, and then somehow, in some cases, tells you about the actual world. So think about mind recognition as Carol described it yesterday. Jackson and Chalmers, and Beale, I think you start with thinking about the concept of consciousness, realizing that we conceive of brains without feelings, and then they infer it's possible to have brains without feelings, and then they infer that brains can't be the same as feelings, and I don't think that's what's going on at all. I think we start with the thought that in the actual world, as a matter of synthetic fact, brains and feelings are separate. I don't believe this thought, but that's the thought that places itself on us. And then we conclude from that that, of course, it's possible to have brains without feelings because brains and feelings are different things. And I think there's lots of cases where the primary focus is on how things are natural. Is this identical with that? Is this made of that? Does this come from that? And given that's what we're interested in, we will really need to be involved with modal things. Sometimes it's helpful for philosophers to focus on the modal issue rather than the actual issue. So think of the mind-brain case. I mean, here's so you know that brains and feelings are always associated in the actual world. Does this mean that they're the same thing, or that they're two separate things that happen to be correlated? What is it that we think about this? And we can figure out what we think about this by asking a modal question which focuses it. Do you think it's possible to have a brain without the feelings? If you say yes, well then you're thinking of them in natural words associated. If you say no, then you're thinking it's the same thing. I mean, this is a slightly odd example because I don't really believe what the modal intuition implies, but here's another one. Do you think of individuals, people, computers, cuffs, as bundles of properties or something over and above? Things and the bundles of properties associated with the natural world, but do we think of them as the same thing, or do we think of them as two separate existences? Well, ask yourself, could there be a world in which I and all the primary properties and vice versa? And many people persuade themselves, yes, change a couple of them and then carry on changing them, and surely it's possible that there could be a world in which I had all these properties and had all that. If you think that that is possible, well then you'll think that I'm separate from my bundle of properties, if you think that. Here's another case. Some people are very struck by the fact that consciousness is closely associated with interaction with the external world, particularly through perception and action. So here's a question you might ask yourself. Do you think that these are two separate things, the conscious feelings and perceptions and the interaction with the world, or do you think that the consciousness is constituted by the interaction with the world? Not quite sure what people like Alvin Weiss is learning to think. Well, here's one way to find out what they think. Ask them, do they think it's possible that you could have the consciousness without interaction? If they really think they're the same thing, they should say no, it's not possible. If they say, yes, we could have them one without the other, then they don't think they're the same thing. They think that they're two things that are closely associated, but are distinct in the actual world. We know what's going on here. There's no fancy attempt to establish philosophical conclusions by starting with intuitions about outlandish possibilities and ending up with it. About actual world. That's not what's going on at all. What's going on is we're just testing what we really think by asking ourselves, do you believe the modal implications? If you don't believe the modal implications, then you don't believe in the first place. It's just a diagnosis for what we think about the actual world. So there's no special kind of, as I had it before, epistemological route that goes by the modal to the actual. It's just we're trying to figure out what we actually think by identifying what we think about the modal implications. So somebody who really does think that consciousness is constitutively connected with interaction with the world shouldn't think it's possible to be conscious without interaction. The matrix is a possibility. Okay, so I'm done. Even when we think about the modal kind of thing, of course, is going to, there's no reason to suppose it's possible. As currently practiced, all the algebraic experiments is doing just in the same way as synthetic theorems and as science. Thank you very much. Okay, Ingo.
One comment and one quick one. Comment, I don't know if you're aware of the dealing between Jim Brown and John Horton or Horton experiments in physics. So now, Jim Brown thinks that all experiments physics show that physics somehow has sort of a priori ability to say keeping the plate is real. Yeah. That's how we operate with this. We use a lot of a priori intuition. And Norton, Edward Norton, in contrast, in high school, right, of course, in my view that all experiments that are in physics and science are just arguments, shouldn't be inductive, but arguments sometimes are inductive. And I take it.
I'm an open. I hope.
Yes, and I take it from the idea that all experiments are arguing also good model for all experiments. In the Galileo case, what you do is to show that given empirical or synthetic assumptions like Aristotle's views and probably some all the empirical additions, you can derive some sort of absurd view so you can figure out what's going on. Kind of more philosophical case, like in Kepler case, you have sort of one intuition that knowledge is justified through belief, but you also have the intuition that in the Kepler case you have knowledge of this view of contradiction, and you have to figure out given this or that. So I think you would call it really that.
Tim Wilson has said some interesting stuff that. He wants to think of them as involving counterfactual thinking rather than explicit argument from general premises. And his thought is just this. As I was presenting it, the thought experiment hinges on the idea that somebody who's an accidentally true believer will not be a general thing. And he thinks, well, if you examine that, that's probably not true because there'll be lots of cases where you put in some more governors and then the guy who satisfies the initial description is a knower. And so his thought is all that's really going on is that in the nearest possible case, in the most plausible possible case, something like that. But I think that's a bit of fine tuning.
So more critical point, can you go back to the slide where you have the camera plan? Because it strikes me that you're unfair to those who claim to be conceptual analysis.
Okay. In fact, I meant to put, and they say it's conceptual analysis.
One slide further.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one. Yeah. Here. So, even one slide further.
then we get to Brandon and the verification.
Back again, sorry. I think you said, but you didn't have it on.
Never mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. So, I agree that sort of maybe the philosophical question should be the Ramsey synthetic question, whether there's belief, whether there's consciousness. But you claim that the conceptual analysis guys, when they talk about setting an agenda, determining the topic or the subject, then they mean the Ramsey sense of scholarly commas. Wrong about that. When Jackson and Chalmers try to analyze the concept of belief, belief or consciousness, they try to find the kind of formula T that defines what we mean by being, which is supposed to be kind of sentence on your essence.
Sure.
So their conceptual analysis is in fact getting at the analytic kind of sentence.
Okay, so.
Even what philosophy should be about or is about to a large extent is the inverse sentence.
I think that book is not very clear. I mean, at one point he actually gives the Ramsey sentence, not a Carnap sentence, as the kind of thing you get out of the first stage, which is embarrassing. But I've been in other places in the book. He says we need to identify the meanings of everyday terms because we want to be singing from the same sheet as the ordinary people. We want to use terms in the same way as they do, otherwise we'll be changing the subject. And I guess that's just more than saying that each problem should be in four parts. I mean, it doesn't really make sense. What's important is not that we speak with the same terminology as ordinary people and our everyday selves, because that will do when we're talking about souls. What's important is we worry about the theories that the everyday people and our everyday selves have. So, I mean, of course Jackson says he's interested in analysis, and he has a bit of argument to back it up. But I think that bit is very weak, and he could perfectly well drop it from the book and everything else would stand fine.
It's kind of a similar question, but let's forget about this specific case of philosophers. I think that philosophers in general, many times think about which properties a thing has to have in order to be a property of type of this or that type. So basically, they do not agree over your common sense. Because they are not sure if, for example, something with properties, something conscious and independent of the body and something else is the soul. They might argue over the karma sentences.
Very good. They do, quite often, and it makes for very bad philosophy. So I'll give you an example. I did say that at the beginning I was not revisionary. I said that philosophy, as it's already done, is all fine. But I said that this is a sociological thing, and I don't really want to make my thesis hostage to every idiot who ever called himself a philosopher. So, there is some bad stuff, and it's not the kind of thing I'm keen on. But here's a good example. Think of the little theory of belief that I gave you. The beliefs are exceptions, and they have some internal political structure. Okay? This account of the concept of belief, and in particular that last clause, became very important in the debate in the 90s, occasioned by connectionism. And this is Ramsey Stitch Garon famous paper, and then there are lots of responses by Martin Davis. Ramsey Stitch Garon assumed that Carnap sentence for belief. And then they said, look at connectionism. Connectionism says we just got sawdust in our heads. They're kind of things that are called by deception. But no internal causal structure of the right kind. So there are no beliefs, right? And then other people came along and said, who said that, that having internal causal structure is part of the definition of belief? And that's wrong, and we'll just have the more truncated Carnap sentence. And then we can say there are beliefs. And there were a lot of arguments. And in fact, that's what got me interested in Ramsey and Carnapism, just that debate, because I thought there's something wrong there. And there's a sense in which, look, who cares
about the definition of Greece. And here's what's interesting. The connectionists, they claim that behavior can be explained without positive states within the terms of structure. The computationists disagree about that, and that's a serious and technical critical issue. There's short interest in that. And then there's this further issue: if the computationists if the connectionists are right, should we say there are no beliefs or not? And that looked like a completely uninteresting terminological issue. And I think it is. And I think that the right attitude to have to that issue is that the everyday concept of belief is vague. I mean, insofar as it's a vague concept, and what's happened there is that we haven't decided, and why should we have, whether to stick the assumption of these seven causal structure into the analytic bit that is in the higher sentence or even up. And so we are vague in our use of the term belief, and that's why we don't know what to say of connections and it's true. But anyway, that's a bit of terminological decision of no great philosophical interest, and philosophers should not spend much time analyzing the concept of belief. What's interesting is the Ramsey stuff. Are there states of a certain kind of model? To summarize philosophers.
All right, well, we've got time for a couple of quick questions. I think Susie, you had a question?
I have a long debate I want to have that again, and that will speak that to later. I would like to ask whether you think that part of the common philosophy is taxonomic one, which you yourself started today by saying, here are some questions we can ask, here are some philosophical questions, here are the ones which we do seem to go outside of, and we look at physiological elements. You gave examples of that.
I was very inclusive. I just said I want to put, sometimes philosophers do get tangled up in terminological issues, and I think that's not good. But when I was doing the interactive dualism and say, I don't know, realism about properties, the contrast there was not that one topic was good and one wasn't, nor that one was philosophical and one wasn't. I think they're both. I mean, interactive dualism is the kind of thing we're in a theoretical tangle, we don't quite know what to think, it's all very complicated. The only difference is that, as it happens, once interactive dualist view is clearly formulated, it has some pretty direct and direct implications. Whereas, as it happens, once the realism about properties view is formulated, it doesn't have any direct implications of its own direct contrast. So that was the only contrast. But I didn't want to say one was philosophy and one wasn't.
No, I didn't think you could do that. I thought you could say
yes. I don't have very well worked out views about what's characteristic about philosophy, and as we all know, a lot of philosophy merges into stuff which is, by anybody's accounts, pretty indistinguishable from theoretical science. But when we have bits of philosophy, which I want to say is still synthetic theorizing, which doesn't look like theoretical science at all, I'd better say something about how come it's synthetic but not theoretical science. And I have things to say about that, but I didn't want to imply that anything over here wouldn't have empirical implications. So I wanted, is interactive dualism okay to be over here in philosophy rather than empirical science? I don't know. I'm not hugely interested in these taxonomic questions.
This is really a kind of follow-up from the first question asked, but as you were talking, it occurred to me that maybe these philosophers who want to say we're doing conceptual analysis are really using that term a little differently than as you characterized it.
Right.
Maybe what they are getting at and what they want to say is we're reasoning about concepts, or maybe even we're making some kind of a priori evaluation. So you hear philosophers talking about a conceptual revision of theory. So we revise naive set theory on conceptual grounds, or we revise our logic to account for the paradoxes, which accommodate vague predicates. And we're doing some conceptual revision. And, you know, sometimes I think people say that they're doing conceptual analysis and they're speaking loosely just to cover this broader notion of reasoning about our concepts or evaluating in some kind of a priori way. And that's perfectly consistent with just getting analyzing a concept, say knowledge is justified through belief. We do that to get clear. And then we go on to reason about our concepts in the more interesting way that you're suggesting ought to be the concern of philosophy. And as I was listening to you, I was wondering if it was charitable to interpret some of these people as doing conceptual analysis narrowly defined as you do.
Right. This is a kind of tricky issue. And here's one. I mean, sometimes in philosophy, people go in for semantic assent. Instead of reasoning with concepts and words, they start talking about concepts and words. Now, one question. I might observe that in your paper at one point yesterday, you had a phrase where you talked about somebody thinking about concepts, and I wondered why you had it. This kind of, why you were referring to this meta activity rather than just reasoning with the process. One question is it any use? Why does it help to kind of semantically send useful stuff about concepts and this sentence is true and then you kind of go down in a certain sentence? And I it's a messy business and I'm not sure that there is. There are many cases where you get much mileage out of the semantic assent. But suppose one did, it wouldn't be inconsistent with my view because reasoning about concepts is quite likely to be a synthetic business. If you're reasoning about the concepts that we have, this is a highly synthetic matter, which concepts we have, what words we use, what they mean, and so on.
But maybe some of the people categorizing as conceptual, advocating conceptual analysis mean reasoning about our concepts so that they are not in disagreement with you.
No,
so
that, it's a question of whether a charitable interpretation. Yeah. That would be fine. But then we have, then I would want to look carefully about how what they're doing is supposed to work and why they think it's going to get anywhere. But that's another issue.
This talk has been brought to you by the Center for Philosophical Research, Warsaw, Poland. For more talks, check our webpage at www.obf.edu.pl.